Welcome to the first panel of today. I feel very privileged to be joined by the experts alongside me. And most of them don't need any introduction to you guys in the room. But just sort of just to go through that process, we've got Matthew Ball, Senior Director with Willis Towers Watson, Corey Anger, Managing Director with GC Securities, and Matt Burdoff, Head of IR and Fundraising, Hudson Structured Capital Management. Your business cards must be very wide.
They are.
So how we kind of thought about covering this session was the kind of conversations that myself and the panelists have had with kind of several of you, a number of you in the room. Three kind of key themes have come out. The need for this industry to do all it can to reduce surprises. The requirement for improved transparency, and I really want us to dig into what that means, and also the ability to keep counterparts informed. And we'll talk about information flow and things like that. So that's the kind of themes that I want us to explore this morning. In terms of the format, it'll be somewhat chronological. I'd like us to take a look back over the last few years and reflect on what we've seen and the lessons to be learnt. I'd like us to do a little bit of a state of the nation. Where are we now? And finally, I'd like the panelists to kind of look into their crystal balls and forecast forward and sort of see what the future looks like as well. And in order to make this conversation as interesting and interactive as possible, I'd encourage you all in the audience to participate as you see fit. There'll be time at the end for questions, but if you have comments or questions that you think are relevant to the discussion, please raise your hand, and I think Steve will come and find you with a microphone or somebody else. So with that, start with a number. So Vincent can't be here, but he said start with numbers. So anybody want to hazard a guess of the significance of the number 805? 805 is the number of days since the last Artemis in-person conference in February 2022. You know, the theme there was build back stronger. You know, there was lots of discussions about the need for resilience in this asset class. There were conversations about new innovative forms of risk transfer. And really, thankfully, since then, not much has happened. We've had the worst pandemic in over a century. 2020 saw the most active hurricane season on record. It saw the costliest convective storm, US convective storm season on record. 2021, in terms of losses, was the fourth costliest Nat Cat year on record. We had Uri, the costliest winter storm on record. We had Bernd, the costliest European event on record. And then we had Ida as well, the costliest US hurricane since Katrina. So, with all that good stuff, turning to the panel, if I can kind of ask you in turn, if you cast your kind of mind back for the experience that we've had over the last few years, what do you think, wearing your respective hats, have been the key themes that have been top of mind for you?
Oh boy. I think one of the things that's been helpful is we've really had robust growth and execution within the ILS market, despite the challenges of not being able to physically be with our clients to structure these solutions and market these solutions. So it's been quite remarkable that we can take 2 years and still continue on the growth and trajectory of the ILS space. It's been extremely active. You look at the volume of issuances, I think it's been in the range of the mid-40s for each of the last 2 years, with 11 new sponsors coming in each of the last 2 years. I will say that it's, you know, the how each sleeve of ILS has performed isn't uniform. So when I talk about the positive side of it, I'm really talking about the 144A Kappa market, and there's been a rotation of capital to focus on that sleeve because the performance of that sleeve has best matched what was advertised when people bought into it. So if you look at the long-term expected loss versus the long-term impairments and the percentage of impairments, it's actually not radically different. And we're looking at long-term expected loss numbers where we've got models coming back from, you know, to, you know, 1999 all the way up to current vintage. So, you know, if you adjust for the fact that the models have gotten more conservative, it's actually been a fairly consistent performance, and that has attracted a lot of capital. The second reason why that space is doing so well is the fact that there is access to liquidity. And so the times when the capital markets need it may not be the time that may mismatch with whatever's going on in the reinsurance market. And so having access to liquidity is important. And it got validated again when the announcement of, oh my gosh, COVID's happening and starting, that 3 to 4 week period from mid-March to mid-April, it was really important, particularly for the asset managers who put an allocation into this to see that they had liquidity to be able to rebalance their portfolios, to meet margin calls, to rotate into other sectors or just move into cash. The fact that the space was able to perform very well during that was a huge, huge positive. But maybe to kind of bring it in and not be so long-winded, but the other two sleeves have faced more challenges. The sidecar market, which is basically capped collateralized quota shares, it was a concentrated market going into COVID, and it just became even more challenging. And that's where you saw a lot of mismatches of performance relative to what people expected. So when your 1 in 10,000 year wildfire loss is 10 times lower than the actual loss that came through, okay, explain that to me. And then you kept having events kind of hitting the sidecar structures that just weren't as expected. It just wasn't performing. And I think it's a part of an issue, and something that Matt and I have talked about in leading up to this panel is when you go from 2012 to 2016 with our 1 in 100 year of no losses, and you just see the income coming off the sidecars and then move back into the normal pattern of actually getting losses, all of a sudden you see a lot of differences in performance. So that sleeve has become definitely more concentrated, but the need has become even greater for it. So it's kind of perverse in what's going on there. And then the collateralized remarket, I think, is doing okay in the sense that it is a large segment. It still has capital rolling over, but it's not seeing the growth that the 144A market is because of the lack of liquidity. So in general, I think the last 2 years have been interesting in the overall insurance links, kind of asset class.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I have just two things that I think about when you kind of do that look back. And the first is, you know, we've spent a lot of time, at least I've spent a lot of time explaining and talking to investors about things that we probably weren't expecting to spend time explaining or talking about. We call them internally, we think of them as gray swan events, these things that, like, I never expected to spend, you know, weeks explaining why business interruption was maybe going to be a part of this property portfolio that we put together, and spend a lot of time on that, or this freeze in Texas. All of a sudden, you're on the phone talking in the middle of February to people about the building codes in Austin, which aren't necessarily events that you plan for. And I think that's probably something we'll talk about later. But this concept of preparing for maybe unexpected discussions is something that I think probably is true not just in ILS, but probably true in all financial services when you have clients going through, you know, a very unusual time like we've had for the last couple of years. But, you know, preparing for those discussions and spending time talking to folks about things that maybe you weren't expecting to. It was an interesting twist. And then the second piece I would add is, you know, the resilience of everybody from investors to fund managers to service providers to pivot how this whole world operates really on a dime in a matter of weeks. And you had investors 2 years ago who wouldn't dream of making an investment in the space without going on site and doing their diligence and sitting in the meeting and making sure you have the right computer systems and security and moving that online. Even conferences like Steve's is a remarkable pivot to just sort of snap your fingers and do. And I think the industry did a very good job of that. It's credit to a lot of the service providers and a lot of the people that make that happen, but, you know, to be able to function, events aside, relatively seamlessly, was an impressive turn for an industry that isn't super well known for being quick on its feet.
Yeah, I think the things I'd add to that is what we've seen as a firm, we help out a lot with the post-event valuation side of things. That could be for funds, it could be for cat bonds, could be for sidecars. And I think the last few years, from 2017 onwards, There's definitely been a renewed focus on valuation. During the years 2012 to 2016, it was the focus was on how do we earn the premium, right? There's not as many losses happening there. But I think there's definitely been a renewed focus on that. There's been some tricky losses, including COVID itself, right? But it's come back to the fore. I think there has been, the industry is improved in that respect, so there's definitely more governance around valuation. If I go back to 2012, 2010, when I first moved to Bermuda, it's a bit like the Wild West, right? But I think that is improving the governance around that. And then the other thing we've noticed is some of the questions are changing, right? So as well as just the valuation question, what's my NAV, etc., I think there's a renewed focus on reserve risk. Okay, so especially if you look at events like COVID, but how should funds, counterparties, and investors think about reserve risk? And that's for two reasons. One is to help with the actual valuation itself, right? So what sort of risk margin should we apply to our liabilities? And the second is, as losses have come in the last few years in particular, the question around liquidity and collateral release, and how do we get the money back to the investors, and how do we communicate that? And I think reserve risk is a key part of that equation. So that's been a different question. And then just to touch on Matt's point there about the operational side, right? I think, and this is an ILS plus an industry-wide thing, but I think there is more questions coming in on how do we operationalize things better. You know, resources are getting dragged into the valuation, communicating things. How do we automate things better? So I think there's a technology piece, a digitization piece that you know, the ILS industry is working on. But that's probably also an insurance industry thing in general. So they're the three things. Valuation has still become even more core. But the questions have changed a bit, right, given the amount of losses over the last few years.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. My sort of follow-up question was going to be, and I think each of you have touched on some of these, so maybe we'll skim through this quite quickly, but in terms of specific areas of frustration that you feel investors have had over the last few years, is there anything else that you would add in addition to your kind of opening comments, just to get it out in the open?
You know, one of the things that I've heard a lot about people, we need to be more transparent, you need to give us better post-event loss information on these type of conferences. But I've actually taken a step back as we've discussed this topic, and I think it's a lot more nuanced than that. There are reasons in every scenario, you learn something new and you want to provide additional information. But the push from the investor base to have adequate reserves that don't get adverse 24 hours after the event is just unrealistic. You're gonna get a bad number if you don't give enough time for clients to assess the situation. With Hurricane Ida, we had people asking about what the Louisiana losses were when it hadn't cleared Louisiana. That's just silly. And even the fact, even when it did clear, okay, what are my loss numbers? Did you follow the storm? It's hitting the Northeast right now. Like, let's wait until we have the time to do this. But I actually wanna kind of flip a little bit on that predictability, because I think there's different links in the chain that cause that information asymmetry and concern. And so one area may be, yes, is the sponsor providing you adequate information post-event? So that's one thing that you need to think about. And my thoughts on that are, and the way that I am positioned in within GC Securities with Guy Carpenter, is I'm linked in with the broker teams. And so on our deals, I am very vocal about the fact that information needs to be consistent in what's going to both markets. And so hopefully you've seen over the last 5 to 7 years that as information's being released, you're actually getting more than you're contractually required. And half the problem is the sponsors don't really know what is needed and not needed. If we tell them that you only have to provide a report mandatorily at this point, then I'll only do it then. But my traditional markets require it earlier, so I'm giving it to them earlier. But they're not thinking that wait a minute, there is seepage between, you know, ILS investors can write in both forms and the information asymmetry that comes out. So it's really a dialogue that I have with the sponsors in conjunction with the broking team to say, don't just put it out there, give us a chance to review it. But every time I review the materials, because it's going out in a securities context, well, hang on a second, what did you mean by this wording? And let's make sure that we're more exact on it. So actually the product improves for both markets because of the conversation that's happening there. So I've heard for the last 5 years that, you know, we need faster response. I've already told you my concerns about being too fast, and I've told you about what we're trying to do, improve the information flow so that you can have proper valuations for it. But in the conversations with my panelists, it came to realize that maybe it's not just what we're giving, it's how it's being processed by the funds as well. And the fact that you may have the same risk in five different funds that are coming up with different valuations on their portfolio, but inherent is the same treaty that may be flowing through five different times. So I don't think it's fair to always position that the sponsors aren't providing adequate information. There has to be some ownership on the investors as well in how they're showing the valuation of that risk. But then I also want to take a step back even before you get into the risk situation. Now, I'm going to gripe to the investor base about this in that you want transparency. I would love to have transparency as a structure who starts with my clients 4 months before I come to market. What is your risk appetite? What are the problem terms and conditions? What is your capital position? And I find that the industry is not as forthcoming, and we deal with shifting sands. And the hard thing about this market is, unlike the traditional market, both in pricing and capacity, it's a, like a slow glide path in movements. We're going to come down, we're going to go up. This market just goes bam, and we feel it in a week to 2 weeks, and all of a sudden we have to interpret what this means. And so we're going through a shift like that right now, and I would challenge the investor community in the way that you want us to improve with our sponsors and communication. I challenge the investor community to come back and be more transparent early, because a client that spent 3.5 months getting to a point of bringing transactions that we've spent 10 years, it may be their first time to come into the market, and then to suddenly have that shift and not have any surprise, or not have any our ability to signal it, then you just create kind of not the relationship and the tone for this space that you want with that particular student. And so I do think that the predictability element needs to actually work both ways. And I probably wouldn't have said this 4 years ago, but it's something that as I've thought about, and you know, I've been doing this for 23 years, you know, what we're experiencing right now is very unique for something that I've seen in my career.
Matt Ball told me he knew the Ida losses the day after, so I agree with what you're saying. I think you can play a little bit of offense when an event is you know it's coming, and you can be, you know, proactive on that side when you're and being getting in front of investors when an event is approaching, because you know you can do things like compare it to historical storm paths and things like that, and play a little bit of weatherman, you know, with your clients. But I think part of setting expectations and that sort of proactivity you have to have with your investors leading up to it is pretty clear messaging around the time that it takes. And we were talking about this last night, just comparing a default in a fixed income security to an event, an ILS security, and the timelines and expectations around those two have sort of mismatched. And I think it's probably helpful to think about, you know, when a company is in trouble and the workout expectations and timelines around that versus an event making landfall and working its way through the insurance, the reinsurance, and the retro markets, and thinking about when your information will be most accurate, because it's no better to just mark something to the most draconian possible outcomes and then creep it back if it gets better. It's not great to creep it worse because you have to deliver bad news to your investors if an event deteriorates. But it's not much better to just slam a huge markdown on it and cut up. You want to actually provide, you know, Matt can talk about this better than me, but you want to provide a reasonable, you know, pathway to an outcome. And so thinking about it in that context of maybe the traditional capital markets may be helpful when you're sort of setting expectations. I don't know if you have anything to add on that.
Yeah, I mean, Corey's analogy was a good one, right? First, I think there can be an unreasonable expectation. I think the answer is you can put a mark on after 24 hours. It's just a very wide range, right? And that's back to the reserve uncertainty part. And I think, I don't know if that's up to the industry to sort of educate the investors more, but I mean, two examples. I mean, you can kind of understand why there was a bit of, investors were a bit upset with losses like Irma, right? And that took sort of everyone a bit by surprise, the extent of that loss creep, right? And, you know, when investors are coming into ILS, they didn't necessarily know they were taking on that sort of systemic loss creep across the market. And I think COVID's another great example, like March, April 2020, we were getting lots of calls on how on earth should we book this in our fund. And the conversation started off with, well, you know, first of all, before you even think about marking one number, you have to figure out, well, how high is up, right? How wide is this potential range? And in those early days, it was more, from our perspective, more of a risk management question. How high is up? And then the amount you marked it for was sort of an emergent property. Well, that's sort of an expected loss plus a risk margin, right? But again, it's how you... What's the best way to communicate that to investors, right? I don't think a single number communicates the uncertainty around COVID after a month to your investors. I think you need more than that. You need to describe the uncertainty around that. And then again, you know, when there's been some investors to-ing and fro-ing, some leaving the industry after a number of years of losses, and I think, you know, maybe we could do a better job of how telling investors up front of being clearer, how will they get their collateral back, right? And I think
how and when.
And I think, you know, perhaps if as an industry we were clear with that up front, and this is mainly for the illiquid assets like collateralizer, et cetera, then that may help avoid surprises later on. But that, you know, that's, yeah.
That's super helpful, Matt. And in fact, you've seamlessly helped sort of transition to where I wanted to kind of steer us anyway. So last night's prep clearly worked really well.
You can't give away the secrets like that.
No, I know. Yeah, it's all smoke and mirrors up here. So I wanted to, I don't know, just might just pause for a second. Any of the conversations that we've had so far chime, resonate, any controversy there? Any questions, any comments? No, silence is compliance. Perfect. So
you got one.
Oh.
I just quickly said I'm a bit upset with Irma.
You know, the experience we had with Irma from an investor perspective is absolutely frustrating because we had a loss creep, initial loss kind of estimate to final now, where we have 300-400% between, right? And the questions we get from the investors, if they can't value it, how do they want to underwrite it? I think this is a fair point. And the second thing which has been pushing people away at the moment is COVID business interruption. Because I don't know how you guys see it, but that's a risk we never got premium for and we have to pay losses. And those things, that's what we call negative surprises. And that's something which is super hard to explain. And the industry always puts it kind of like, investors don't want to pay losses. That's not true. We had no issues with paying our losses with Texas freeze, where he went, happens. We had no issues with German floods paying 10 billion plus for Germany, big event. But we have kind of like issues with loss creep over 3-4 years where we exactly know where it's coming from. You guys might be happy with social inflation for us. From an investment asset management point of view, it's simply fraud. And then we have the second thing, not even 2 years later, and with BI, with COVID, which is also an extreme surprise, and that's poisoning the mood of investors. And that's a real problem where we really have to address, not only on the valuation side, but also on the underwriting side, to get terms and conditions clear, that in the end, we know which risks we are carrying, where we are getting premium for, and then we don't have an issue also accepting losses. That's just a comment from our side, apologize, but it's not a bit upset. We are a lot upset.
Apology for the British understatement.
I actually think those are kind of interesting comments. One of the things that I saw out of the industry was the traditional market was always, they're always going to pay. They're my, you know, benchmark counterparty. I've had a long-standing relationship. I don't know if ILS will pay. And we've had enough loss experience in all forms of ILS that, thank God, I don't hear that anymore at conferences. I think everybody gets that you have a relationship and they have paid losses. But through COVID, actually, is where I saw a pivot in some of the cedents and saying, I'm not sure my traditional market may pay. The dispute risk became really real, particularly with the COVID-related losses. But that was a pivot point with some clients of saying, maybe I'm not so locked with that client in that will they pay or how they'll pay. And I think that that was an it's been an opportunity to wedge in more ILS-related opportunities. I think the gripe about Irma, we can complain to our underlying cedents, but honestly, this is a legislative problem in Florida. Okay, the perpetuation of the legal industry in constantly tweaking what they can litigate or how they can get claims that are put in. These companies, you know, are doing the best in the information that they have, but the legal industry isn't static. So every time we move a needle and we think we get a handle, even for an existing event that happened, they tweak it somehow and there's a new legal angle and they still have cases going on beyond the statutory limit. So I actually think it's at this point for that event is more of a legislative concern. And that's something that Florida has to address. I know that there's a call for a special session. I have no idea if anything will actually come meaningfully out of that. I think that my fear would be if they actually do something, they do a Band-Aid again. I would rather see, you know, if it needs to take out longer, material action, you know, kind of a one and done type of situation. But those are just some of my comments back to what you'd say, your comments.
Matt, do you want?
Yeah, and I think I totally agree. I mean, these things you should be getting premium from up front. And soon after Irma, you know, there are things you can do to maybe allow for some of that. So you can look at the legislative risk, maybe at the county level, right? And if you wanted to, as well as the sort of underlying peril risk, you should be able to overlay sort of an extra legal risk on that, right? It depends on, you know, the specific location in Florida. There are ways to learn from that and build it in. I don't think it was not built in to that premium. But hopefully the market's learning from that. I think you should get paid for that, and you should get paid for the once a loss happens, what's the reserve risk and the capital drag, right, on that post event. Not always totally sure that does get into the models. On the COVID point, actually, I mean, it's got a long way to play out yet, and lots of legal arbitrations to happen, but actually on the retro side for named perils, I think they're, you know, it's going okay, and even I think we're starting to see a few favourable arbitrations where there's wording in there with named perils including but not limited to, a bit of a grey area. I think if you've got a standard all risk policy closer to the traditional market, then I think that, you know, you're more at risk there. But actually, a lot of the ILS funds did have tighter wording than the traditional market. And I think there should be definitely lessons learned there going forward about can we get it even tighter.
Well, when there's fewer and fewer dollars to go around, the language will get tighter because there'll be fewer places to go for loose language. I think that I echo your statements because I talk with investors all the time and have the same conversations. I think that... Part of the rhetoric that I think also needs to change leading up to renewal dates is around rates, because there's always lots of talk, at least I have them with investors, I see it, you know, everywhere. How much are rates going to go up after an event? What's the rate change year over year? And the concept of what's the risk change year over year doesn't really get as much love, and it should, because you're just talking about how these conversations are about unexpected, you're getting paid for things you weren't expected to. Well, Well, that's like a sort of a mischaracterization of the risk that's being put into some of these deals that are going into either your ILS portfolio or you're selling, you know, to clients in cap bonds or whatever. So I think that there needs to be a more explicit focus when you're talking about putting together an ILS portfolio around how risk is changing year over year. And it honestly is, especially if the terms and conditions are changing in the contracts, if legislation is changing in key markets. There should be more explicit discussion around how's the risk changing, not just how far are rates going to go up after this event. And I understand that investors' intuition is, okay, I'm going to get paid X more dollars. This is a great story to take to my committee, whatever it may be, to get approval for the allocation or whatever. But understanding if you have rates up 25%, but the risk is up 30%, you're actually not getting paid for the changing risk environment. So you should, at the very least, have equal footing for both of those concepts. But I don't think we're there. And I think people are interested in looking at the no loss or looking at your exceedance curve to figure out, you know, how does this compare to last year from a return perspective? Well, how does this compare to last year from a risk perspective is equally as important discussion and doesn't get as much airtime. So I think it should get as more airtime.
And part of the thing about it, at least to Irma, was the AOB and the social inflation type of risk just can't be captured in models. So we're looking at the exposure changes from something where you're seeing you can capture the increase, but you have this whole piece that you don't know how big it is. And remember that before Irma, when was the last landfalling hurricane in Florida? So this legal, you know, symptom probably had been going on. It started with sinkholes. So it had been going on for long, but it was more for non-cat losses where it was being apparent. And everyone kind of felt that it wasn't going to affect when a cat loss happened. And all of a sudden we realized, no, that was just an opportunity for, you know, plaintiffs' counsel to, you know, leverage their business, you know, post that event. So I think that's also one of the things is that's the surprising is because we didn't have activity to get us more attuned of, okay, on a not as strong of an event, but we're seeing this, we need to start pricing it in. You know, it's just something that people didn't appreciate as much in the cat. So, you know, that's the inelegance of insurance risk, frankly.
Of the ILS manager industry to apparently protect their end investors from bad terms and conditions and from loss creep, as we have seen. Because the end result, if we don't get that under control, you know what the end result is going to be. Primary Floridian going to be excluded, or people are walking away, or you have this massive shift that suddenly everyone wants to only hold cap bonds. There will be voting by foot. And it's, from my point of view, honestly, it's too easy to say it's the regulatory issue. Well, if you have a regulatory issue or if you have a legal uncertainty, then don't write it, right? If you're not kind of like 100% sure what you underwrite, then just don't do it. And there, I see where you're coming from, I have full understanding. On the other side, also would kind of like highlight the fiduciary duty of the ILS manager to apparently protect the investor from negative surprises, as we have seen. But there's a lot of gray between, I understand. But thanks for elaborating on the question.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
I'm Ross Stein from Tembler, and I really have a question for you. Given what you've described, wouldn't you be happy with a parametric bond? Doesn't solve every problem because there is climate change, but that's a slow effect. You're talking about massive effects that could be eliminated in a parametric cover. So why aren't you saying, that's what I need?
So what's the volume? So what's the market share of parametric, right? I mean, in the end, I don't know, is it $200, $300, $400 million? Do you have $100 billion market to place? So I understand that the basis risk wants to be pushed back from I understand that someone has to bury the basis risk, but at the moment, given the ratio of indemnity coverage at the moment, I think the basis risk is definitely on the end investor. And if the industry is willing to take some of the basis risk back, and I think that's going to happen if people pull back, then indemnity trigger and the PCS triggers, they will get a higher ratio. as a, because they hope to get a higher valuation certainty with it, right? I don't know if that's a fair response.
All right. Cool. All right. Thank you. Just kind of pulling on this thread a little bit, just on the sort of the investor experience and expectation management. And again, we've touched on a few of these points, but I'd like to explore it a little bit further. Is there a risk in the kind of the panelists' minds that, you know, ILS has been slightly oversold as an asset class? Have we been guilty in the past of, you know, being, you know, quite brazen about how sophisticated our models are and how smart our underwriting is and how smart our portfolio management is, that actually some of the events of the last few years have perhaps challenged that a little bit? Matt, you're looking quizzical. No.
Well, as the least sophisticated on the panel, I can start. You know, when everybody starts working in insurance, the first thing that I noticed was the number of acronyms and the language that people speak, which can seem overwhelming until you understand that they're really just mostly just ways to sound smart, and they're kind of all the same concept, which is just like, you know, you pay a premium, and if something goes wrong, you get that money back and they'll cover your loss. And so I think that is sort of a more cultural thing more than anything, which is this weird like gatekeeping of intellectual property of what insurance is offering to the capital markets and financial services investors. I don't know if I buy that it's we've oversold it as ultimately more intellectual than it actually is, but it's just the pattern of outcome by year is so unusual, where if you basically do nothing but make money for 10 years leading up to a period where you do nothing but lose money for 5 years, if you think about that as if every other year you made money, every other year you lost money, I think investors may have had a more tolerable experience and looked at it on a more holistic basis over a 15-year period where they made money. In some years they made it more, in some years they lost more, but on the whole they did. But the experience wasn't that. It was 10 years of minting money and then a very difficult period immediately following it. And if you average that out, it's not horrible. But if you look at just that last 5 years, it is horrible. So you get these people that are trying to time the market, and you have folks that have been in for a long, long time, and they have vastly different opinions of what ILS means to their portfolio, or means to their investment committee, or means to them as an allocator. And that needs to be picked apart a little bit better by the industry, because I think showing up with the same exact rhetoric that was in 2014 today is useless, and you'll be laughed out of the room because, oh, it's uncorrelated, and it's quantifiable, and it's well documented historically. Like, that whole story that really held together nicely from like 2012 to 2016, it just doesn't hold together anymore. You need to be more thoughtful around changes year to year. What are the changes in risk? What are the changes? How are you getting paid more or less for what you're doing? What's the presence of supply and demand, and how does that affect what's going on? There's much more nuance to the story than in a period where you just are just making money every year and you can point to historical returns and then explain it in a very like opaque way. So you have to end up being, you have to be more, both more transparent but also more nuanced in how you're explaining the value to the investors, because the way that it was put together 15, 20, 10 years ago is just so different in the mind's eye of an investor.
And I think the interesting point is we were discussing the no to low correlation, and it should never be no correlation, because there is. There's incidental correlation. I mean, there shouldn't be, a stock market crash isn't going to cause a hurricane or an earthquake to happen, so, okay, that's how we get to low. But one interesting facet that we started to talk about was, are we raising the correlation because of our human behavior in the decision-making of the asset class? And so that is a catalyst, I think, for why it may not be the same. This, you know, I think we also said, listen, you know, most strategies, I mean, hedge funds try to make money by moving in and out. Some do it consistently well for periods of time, but I would say the majority of the industry struggles, you know, meeting a benchmark. But, you know, if you're in an asset class, it's really, you got to be through the cycles on this stuff, and this is not a market timing type of asset class. But I'll remind you is that the end source money, they think they know how to lose money on traditional capital markets products. I understand that I think I can see that this asset class is going to fall over. They don't. They have the same struggles that they are. It's just they don't see the digital nature of that. My investment may not have any value. You know, it's the fact that maybe when it defaults because of the assets of the company, maybe it's 60% valuation off. So it's the magnitude of loss that they see and the rapidness of the nature of the change. But it's all because they just don't understand the acronyms. You know, when I worked at Lehman Brothers, you know, I had bosses who would come in from other sectors and would lead the ILS thing, and they would we could talk expected loss, they talk effective loss. It's the same concepts that you have there. They just need to have that translator tool to understand how I benchmark it in the traditional capital markets and how I look at it here.
Yeah, on the correlation stuff, you know, one of the big selling points and reasons that the ILS market kind of hockey sticked in its AUM during and immediately after the financial crisis is that there's no events, and then the world fell apart, and all of a sudden this is one of the only places that's making money. And that's definitely true, but there are also different pieces of that equation that do have some inherent correlation. That's what I think you were talking about when you're going through a cycle now where there's more things like geopolitical unrest and the market's down and liquidity isn't what it was 12 months ago. That'll affect the number of dollars available to purchase a cat bond when you're going out to syndicate it. That's correlation, it just is. But it's like capital supply correlation more than outcome-based market correlation. But it is correlation. It's the same thing happens when the market craters and, you know, capital markets investors have margin calls to meet, and one of the only places they can find liquidity or assets that are money good are cat bonds. So they have to make a run on the cat bond market, so spreads blow out. That's also correlation. Now, it's not outcome correlation, where like if there's some Fed policy adjustment, your collateralized reinsurance value changes, but it still is. And so we do a lot of, at Hudson, we do a lot of non-CAT investing. And one of the questions we're constantly talking with investors about is if you vary outside of the CAT markets, do you start to pick up more correlation? We obviously tell them no, but you know, I think that maybe it's under-accounted for in the traditional markets because of those factors. And you're starting to see them, I'm sure, in your seat now as you're trying to put together a pipeline and syndicate out deals. We'll see it in the allocator circles who, if all of a sudden their, you know, uncorrelated or absolute return bucket is having struggles because maybe it's not as absolute or not as uncorrelated as they thought when the world goes south. It's an interesting time, actually, for this market to shine because when other parts of the world are down, if you're properly situating your pitch to your investors, you can actually be extremely valuable to them because they have bosses to answer to also. If you have something that's unique and well explained at the outset and they understand there can be things like supply correlation or things like that, but you know generally it's less tied in, it can be a great time for ILS. It's just a matter of how you manage those expectations going in.
Yeah, and I think just to add, agree with those points, and just to add, I mean, use the word oversold, but maybe that there could be more clarity in what is and is not in the models, right? Are you modeling legislative risk somehow? Am I getting premium for that? And then on the post-event side, I think there could be better communication on that reserve risk, and I think the industry's found out that the collateral perhaps wasn't as fungible as first anticipated, right? So we need to learn from that and get better at that communication.
Okay. All right, perfect. Thank you. One eye on the clock. Perhaps sort of to start kind of wrapping things up, if I could ask the panel to kind of look into your sort of respective crystal balls again under the heading of transparency and reduction of surprises. Are there specific themes that you currently see or you would like to see kind of playing out over the course of the next 2, 3, 5 years that you think will help improve investor experiences?
Well, the most surprising thing at this point would be no losses. so that would be nice.
Yep.
No, I, But looking farther down the road, 2, 3, 5 years, hopefully we're having, you know, a panel that's twice this size with twice as many people that Steve gets to come. But, you know, the discussions are panels on different types of ILS, not just so focused on property cat, that there's continued growth in the market to build a real insurance-linked securities complex around different types of insurance-linked risk outside of traditional property cat, so that you can, I think that's the way the market continues to really expand and become institutionalized as you start, and you're starting to see it in life, you're certainly starting to see it in runoff, in casualty and in life, but continued expansion outside of the silos that exist is what's most exciting for me to talk about, because we've been beating the drum of property cat for multiple decades now, and it's had its ups and it's had its downs, but in order to continue to grow and evolve the same way that the P&C market has grown and evolved in the last 20 years, you need to start that again in a different, you know, part of the market, because insurance is such a vast, complicated, and capital-intensive part of the financial services world. If we put as much time and effort into other sectors of insurance as we do into the property cat stuff, I think you can find great product innovation, great investment opportunities, and not necessarily pick up correlation, despite what some people may say. So hopefully 2, 3, 5 years from now, we will have, there'll be a panel on problems in life ILS and problems in casualty ILS and problems in cat ILS. And so that expansion is exciting.
Matt?
Yeah, just to touch on that, I think the key is, again, if we look back 5 years' time, the industry will be much better at reserve risk and liquidity management, and I think that relates to, that will naturally open up some more non-cat lines, right? I mean, you seriously want to get into casualty, you have to be very good at managing that collateral release, otherwise the product doesn't work.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think you know, when we are facing turbulent times on the property cat side, it basically shuts down our ability to think about innovation because of the construct of the money that's in the space. If we have money that's more willing to diversify and look on other perils, that is a catalyst for us to be moving on creating structures around that. But with so much of the market focused on property cat, that's where it is. And when you go through times of period of stress where, okay, maybe not every structure is being placed in the robust way that you want and pricing is moving and terms and conditions are adverse, it frankly, on the structuring side, becomes very hard to go, okay, I want to stop and think about this new innovative field when I can't sell what is the plain vanilla product right now. So basically, when we hit those stress periods in the property cat market, it slows that innovation on the other areas. But with that being said, I mean, there's been a, you know, this market for a long time has always done very neat, fun, innovative transactions. You know, the life market started with, you know, embedded value securitizations, then it moved to regulatory capital relief transactions, so XXX and AXXX, which then moved to the bank market, which then there's all these, you know, you've got the kind of annuity, you know, fee annuity securitization transactions. There's all this stuff that's been happening for 20 years. It's just the volumes haven't necessarily always rivaled, or they end up moving to a segment of the market. So, you know, for the period of time, you know, the XXX and AXXX all moved into the bank market. It moved away from kind of being securitized. And then there's, you know, the stuff that you're doing now, which is kind of new and cutting edge and pushing it in different ways. Casualty is talked a lot about and definitely gets a push. I know there's some folks that will be talking about cyber. A lot of focus been on trying to expand that peril realm. And you can look that, you know, Pool Ray did a larger terror transaction earlier in the year. So we continue to push the edges. It's just it slows down a little bit, I find, when we reach these points where the mainstream, you know, segment is facing a lot of questions.
Well, one of the reasons why it hasn't garnered the volume that the property cat market has is at least at what I've heard, is always because you're taking more illiquidity because you have longer tail risks. And the one of the, you know, rallying cries for ILS was that, you know, it's 12 months and it's more liquid than, you know, a multi-year life transaction or a multi-year runoff casualty transaction. But the truth of the matter is, it's not 12 months. It's 24 months. Sometimes it's 36 months. Sometimes it's longer. Why not just spend 36 months in a multi-year transaction that's less volatile? That's what I never really understood. It's like, I guess at the beginning, if everything goes right and you get your money back in January of the next year, all is great. But if that doesn't happen and all of a sudden you're still working through trapped collateral from 2018 and 2022, what's the point? You're just degrading your IRR and I guess you're maybe in some cases losing money more slowly. But like you compare that to the value of a multi-year life transaction that has cash flow associated with it. Like, you're not picking up any more market correlation. If anything, you're diversifying your pool of insurance risk. And the liquidity isn't that much different. So you just have to figure out how to get investors comfortable with taking that illiquidity risk. Because there's less vol, you're probably just not going to earn as much because there's less vol.
Is there less vol in all? Does it depend on what time of the market you're measuring it against? Because,
right,
you know, like, yeah, life side has more asset intensive. So when we hit, you know, financial crisis type stuff, it may have more vol than we were expecting. So, like, right, it's all perspective. And it's like, it's fine during the risk period. We can go out 36 months. And if nothing happens, everything unwinds. That's real easy. It's the hard part is, uh-oh, we may have something and how long it takes to develop. And with the length of the tail and the basis risk that the cedents are willing to take. So, I mean, like, we could probably sit up here for an hour and debate this. I would find it interesting.
I don't know
if you would, but I actually would find it.
Come to the last few minutes. Any other questions or comments or thoughts from the audience? Okay. All right. Well,
there's one.
Oh. Hi, Mina Skalashian from Audience. Matt, you said something interesting. I wonder if you can maybe just, you know, shed some light on it. Is it because in the PNC, I guess in the CAT space, is it people think that you have standardized modeling, it's easier to actually understand because they feel that, you know, whereas in casualty, maybe not in life, it's just more underwriting involved. It's more of a kind of an insurance versus, you know, there's models, it's been around, everybody accepts them, they like it or not. But is that make a difference, you think? Or is it just a kind of a different investors with different views on CAT versus non-CAT?
So the first part of your question I would ask Ben, actually, because he's also now in the world of this, but I don't think any fund, insurance-linked fund, will tell you they have standardized modeling. I think that's every single one of them will tell you, well, we have special modeling. We do this and this and this that no one else does. And I think that's probably true to some extent. We talked about this last night, like, how do you attribute, you know, your value add to the investor? Is it modeling? Is it underwriting? Is it, you know, negotiation or relationships? Is it less standardized in the non-CAT sectors? Definitely. But that's not to say it's not as quantitative. There have been life insurance actuaries just as long as there have been P&C actuaries. It's a different understanding, and it's definitely a higher sort of hurdle in terms of explaining what's going on, because I think you'll see this. You're seeing this now in the public markets with all of these P&C insurance companies that started life insurance companies, because I think that would just add to the value of their business. And now they're realizing it's a bit more complicated, so they're selling them off, much to the delight of Blackstone and KKR and Apollo. But it definitely is a more complicated story to tell. But you know, you have to make the argument that over time, the value proposition of widening the aperture is greater than, you know, than maybe the burden of explaining that over time. So it is definitely a good question and probably something that investors are split on. I don't know the answer that everybody thinks, you know, but that's something we think about pretty much all the time.
Cool. Thank you. Okay, so sounds like still lots of work to do, but some causes for optimism as well at the same time. Thank you for your contributions. Thank you for your attention. And please just join me in thanking the panelists for their insight this morning.